Hello and welcome to Crime Time FM and In Person with Paul. I'm Paul Burke and I write about crime fiction. And here I interview authors about their latest novels. Today my guest is Welsh author Alice Hawkins. And I'm pleased to say this episode is brought to you by Canello Crime, publishers of A Bitter Remedy, the gripping new Victorian Oxford mystery by Alice Hawkins, out in ebook and hardback on the 23rd of March. As soon as I heard about A Bitter Remedy, which probably is about a year ago now, I decided I had to interview Alice about the book. The topic was just so intriguing. And then last November I was on a panel with Alice Hawkins at Newcastle Noir, and the audience was fascinated by her Tyvee Valley Coroner series, which features Harry Probert Lloyd, the blind West Wales coroner. One of the things that really seemed to intrigue people was the different nature of Welsh history as opposed to English history during the 19th century, the period Alice writes about. Now, A Bitter Remedy is set in Oxford, but you will notice it still has this Welsh flavour to it. But of course, it's also about the women's movement, about the right to education, and of course, murder. And we're going to explore all that. But Alice has been one of the driving forces behind a new festival, the first international crime festival in Wales, in fact, which will be held in Aberystwyth. So let's start there. Hello, Alice. Welcome back to Crime Time FM.
Hi, Paul. So really nice to be here.
Yeah, lovely. I thought we might as well start with that, actually, the fact that you were here before, because we spoke with Gail Williams and Philip Gwynne-Jones and Victoria Selman about the online Gwyll Crime Cymru Festival. And of course, this year it's live and it's in Aberystwyth on the 21st to the 23rd of April. And you are, of course, one of the people instrumental in bringing it about. So how's it all going and what do we have to look forward to?
We've got a huge amount to look forward to. I mean, obviously now with, I think it's 5 weeks to go, we are all systems go. I mean, everybody's doing everything. Somebody's right, organising yes. tote bags. Somebody else is sorting out press releases. Gail Williams, our administrator, is, oh, poor woman. I mean, headless chicken doesn't quite come into it. I mean, poor thing. She has no time to write at all.
I notice she's doing her best banging stuff out there on Twitter and social media,
she
though.
She is quite the force of nature. And I do hope that people go on and read her books as well. She publishes
yes, right.
both as Julie Williams and as Abby Barden. But yeah, I mean, we're bringing some fantastic people to Aberystwyth. And it's great that we're finally doing it. Live in person, you know, having done two online festivals, which are nice, but not the same as
The same thing. To have this first international festival actually in Wales is going to be brilliant.
It's going to be fantastic. And you know, we've got some brilliant people. We've got Claire McIntosh, we've got Mary Hannah, we've got Belinda Bauer, we've got David Ben Aronovich. Oh, I can't believe we've got Ben Aronovich. We've got some fantastic Welsh authors, Fleur David, who a lot of people don't know as a novelist because she mostly does screenplays and
yes, right.
for television. Any Welsh speaker in the country knows Fleur's work because every year she has a crime drama on the telly. But she's also a singer-songwriter. She is quite the polymath, is Fleur. We've got Cara Lewis, who was the first winner of the Waterstones Welsh Book of the Year Award. We've got workshops, we've got community engagement events, we've got a dragon parade, we've got a gala quiz night on the first night, we've got a fantastic evening with Claire McIntosh and our very own Philip Gwynne-Jones on Saturday, where we hope that lots of people will come along and sit cabaret style around tables with lots of our visiting authors so that people can actually really get amongst the authors. That's one of our big things with Crime Cymru. We don't
right.
want the authors on the stage and the
yeah.
audience in the auditorium. We genuinely want to facilitate readers and authors meeting, talking, getting to know each other. Yeah, that's we want to be different in that respect.
Yeah. No, it's a brilliant schedule of events. And also, I mean, publisher events and Welsh language panels and talking about Crozy Crime and a feature on Ellis Peters. There's all sorts of things going on. And it will be lovely for people to get involved in that personally because we've lost that contact so much over the last few years. So I'm really looking forward to it.
And if anybody in Aberystwyth area or indeed the rest of Wales who wants to come is interested in actually getting involved at a hands-on level, we're still looking for volunteer stewards.
Ah, that's interesting.
So
yes.
people go onto our website. There's a Getting Involved tab. So if you want to click on that and see what being a steward would be all about, we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, and I'm going to make sure that on the program notes we have the link so that people can get there for tickets and things like that. So that'll be on the program notes.
That'd be great.
So, I mean, that leads us on to something else, actually, which is you've got a panel, actually, called is Wales becoming sexy? And which is nice. I like that. But Welsh crime fiction is finally getting some really serious recognition. And that's thanks to some great authors. It's also thanks to Crime Cymru. So you must be very proud of Crime Cymru and very optimistic for the future.
I'm phenomenally proud of Crime Cymru. I mean, in case people don't know, Crime Cymru, the organisation, as distinct from Crime Cymru Festival, we're a cooperative of Welsh crime writers set up in 2017 by myself and two other crime writers, Rosie Claverton and Matt Johnson, whom I'd met at Crime Fest the previous year.
Yes, right.
I was about to have my first crime novel published, None So Blind, the first in my Tivy Valley Coroner series. And I thought, okay, I need to do some joint working with other Welsh crime writers, you know, see if we can get together, do some events, you know, because trying to market a book as an unknown is horrifically difficult. So I thought, did due diligence on Google and thought, oh gosh, I've met a couple of these people. So I got in touch with Rosie and Matt and said, look, I've had this mad idea about getting together a sort of a little group of us who can do, I mean, even very basic things like retweeting each other's tweets, bigging each other up on social media, occasionally doing events together. What do you reckon? Is that a goer? We met, the three of us, and they said, oh, we think this is a great idea. Let's do it. So we each got in touch with a few other Welsh crime writers. And my gosh, it really has snowballed. So from then to now, we started off with a dozen, I think, crime writers. We now have 40. We have both full and associate members. So to be a full member, you need to be either traditionally published or self-published and selling 500 a year, which is the SOA, the Society of Authors criterion. So we have 40 full members and an equal number of associate members who are either aspiring authors who are not yet published, or they're booksellers, or we have some agents and publishers involved as well, who are all contributing to the success of Welsh crime writing. And now, of course, we've run two very successful online festivals. We've got the real one coming up. We ran the Crime Cymru First Novel Prize last year. So
that's right.
It'll be a biennial event. We've contributed to the Crickhowell Literary Festival. We've done crime fiction days for them. We've done panels at Bloody Scotland and Newcastle Noir. You know, we're getting the message of Welsh crime writing.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Out there. We don't have enough screenwriters yet. We're nearly all crime fiction writers, but I think that's going to change because there's such a kind of cross fertilization between TV drama and crime fiction, especially when you've got people like Fleur David, who I mentioned earlier on when we were chatting. You know, she's known in Wales primarily as a screenwriter, but she also is a very successful novelist. And
I would recommend The Library Suicides to anybody.
Isn't it amazing?
Oh, it's a brilliant book for atmosphere and that kind of creepy feel. It just leaves you with that edgy sort of feel that you've got the whole time.
I mean, the Times review described it as, I think it was called, This Odd Book. And when I interviewed Fleur, I did one of her launch events. And I said, did you mind being referred to as having written an odd book? And she said, they mentioned me. That's all I care about. But it is, it's a little bit different. It's not the average crime fiction thriller. It is a literary thriller, but it is very much a thriller. And I think that's quite typical of Welsh crime writers. We're all coming at things just a little bit from left field. We're not doing the same as everybody else. Even if we're not writing books set in Wales, as Fleur and I do, even if we're setting our books in Paris, like Chris Lloyd, or Venice, like Phil Gwynne-Jones, I think we bring a Welsh sensibility to our books, which is distinctly different to what's happening on the other side of the border.
I absolutely agree with you. And I think people are really genuinely starting to realize that now.
I think they are, yes. I mean, publishers, my own publisher, Canello, are now asking, so they've asked one of my, she's now a Crime Cymru writer, Sarah Ward, to write a book set in Wales. And other publishers are doing similar. Louise Mumford, who's currently co-chair of Crime Cymru, her publisher asked her, could you set your next book in Wales? I mean, 6 years ago, when I was looking for a publisher for None So Blind, all the publishers were rejecting it simply on the basis that it was set in Wales. It's like, people aren't going to read a book set in Wales. And now publishers are asking their authors to write books in Wales.
That shows you the progress you've made with Crime Cymru.
Yeah,
because that's a short period, 6 years, but you're right.
Yeah.
Of course, we see the same thing with people like Simon McLeave, who picks up a contract with a traditional publisher. having been successful in his own right anyway as an independent.
Absolutely.
And it's definitely, people are taking it far more seriously now.
They are, and very much so.
You mentioned that distinct character, and that's an important aspect of your writing. So let's look at it just a little bit generally, first of all, before we talk about a bit of Remedy. You published 7 historical novels, from the Black Death to the mid-19th century in West Wales, and of course now we're in Oxford in 1881. And there's clearly you love history, but there's a particular thing about your work, and this 19th century books in particular, and that's about Welsh history and English history, and they're not the same thing.
No.
Would you just talk a little bit about that? Because I'm not sure people outside of Wales, perhaps, and maybe some inside Wales, don't necessarily grasp how important that is.
I think that's entirely true. I think COVID and the various lockdowns surprised people on the other side of the border greatly when they realised that Wales has a separate government. You know, our first minister was not taking the same line as the Westminster government. Our border was closed. People couldn't just choose to go to Wales. Right. Like, I'm sorry, you're not coming in. And I think that showed a lot of English people, British people generally, for the first time, that it's not just a notion, this business of Wales being a separate country. It's a separate legal entity. Now, obviously, in the 19th century, that wasn't true. It was England and Wales. You know, we didn't have our own parliament. We didn't have such a well-developed national identity. But that doesn't mean that our history wasn't entirely separate. Mm. And not just separate because of geography, you know, Wales is a separate country, but because the development of Wales, and particularly the development of Wales in conjunction with us having a different language, having the Welsh language,
yes, right,
made the development of Wales different. Not just different in terms of the things that happened, but why they happened, how they happened. Religion was different. There was a huge influence of nonconformity in Wales in a much greater way than there was in England. I mean, there were big pockets of nonconformity in England, particularly in the north, but it was everywhere in Wales. And some of the very first Baptist chapels in Britain were in Wales. The Baptists were very, very strong.
It was a reaction to the established religion, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It really was.
Which was seen as English.
Which was seen as English, absolutely. And in the time that I'm writing about, the mid-19th century, you can still see vestiges of the old Welsh legal system, because in the 16th century, the English legal system was imposed on Wales.
Yes.
But prior to that, they were running a system which was really based on the 8th century laws of Hywel Dda, Hywel the Good, King of Wales. Which were incredibly enlightened, particularly when it came to attitudes towards women and this sort of thing. And one of the things which has really fascinated me about the difference between Welsh and English history, which I really didn't know anything about until I started researching into books, despite growing up in West Wales and doing all my education there, I knew very, very little about Welsh history. One of the things which fascinated me was the different attitude to women, and the different attitude of women in Wales. They were much more independent. They were much more inclined to work, particularly in the mid-19th century. Things did change under the influence of increasing anglicisation through the century. And this kind of middle-class attitude of women have no place in the workplace came in, and women were confined to the domestic sphere. But that still wasn't the case, particularly for lower middle class and working class women in Wales in the mid 19th century. They were out there in the thick of it, doing it all, running businesses, employing people. You know, and that kind of carried on a bit into the period that I'm writing about, which is the 1880s. And Non Vaughan, my main character, kind of bodies that forth in a very major way. She is not going to be told what to do by any man. Thank you very much.
No, very much she isn't. Just sticking a little bit with the Tyvee Valley series before we do move on, because I think people will actually, they'll like both series. I think if they like, I like the Bitter Remedy. And I hope that people would then go back and look at the Tyvee Valley Coroner series and have a look at that. And it comes, I think it springs, the first novel anyway, from a very specific thing, which is the Rebecca riots.
Absolutely.
And I think illustrates that difference in history.
Oh, massively. I'd always wanted, ever since I started writing, it had been my ambition to write a book about the Rebecca riots, because nobody in England knows about the Rebecca riots. And quite a lot of people in Wales don't know about the Rebecca riots.
Right.
And they are one of the most fascinating phenomena of social history in the entire UK, the entire 1,000 years of British history.
They should be seen with Chartism, shouldn't they? As radical and that important.
Absolutely. I mean, they were very much, they sprang very much from the same wellspring as Chartism. And of course, they began in the late 1830s at the time when Chartism really was looking as if it might change the world. There's a kind of a century between the Hanoverians coming to the throne and Victoria coming to the throne, where in general people didn't have the vote. You know, before the 1832 Reform Act, the vast, vast majority of the people in the country didn't have the vote.
Right.
So the only way that they could get things changed, if things were really in a bad way and people wanted to say, I'm sorry, we can't have this, their only recourse was to riot, basically. And people did. They rioted over everything from, I mean, we've all heard about bread riots. We've heard about the Peterloo Massacre. But people rioted over the price of theatre tickets. Yes, they rioted about the conditions of silk workers. They rioted about the introduction of agricultural machinery. I think, some people have heard the Tolpa of the Martyrs, for instance, and the swing riots. But all those riots were relatively small and self-contained and mostly burned out in a week. The Rebecca riots, which were a series of, they're always described as tollgate riots because that was the straw that broke the camel's back. There were turnpike roads. So a turnpike means a tollgate, basically. Mm-hmm. Roads were improved in West Wales by setting up tollpike trusts, turnpike trusts, which borrowed money from the government under Acts of Parliament to improve the roads, mainly for the trustees' own benefit, to get to and fro from their own estates, to be honest, and then to market their produce. So they borrowed the money, and then they got the money back via tolls, which were levied on everybody bar pedestrians, basically. At the time, agriculture was going through an awful, awful period of recession. And having to pay tolls, and not only having to pay tolls, but having to pay unjust tolls.
Yes.
Because there was a species of person called the toll farmer. So the trustees, all being, aristocracy and gentry, they didn't want to dirty their hands by actually collecting money. So they sold the right to collect the tolls to a species of person called a toll farmer. And there was a particularly notorious toll farmer called Thomas Bullen in West Wales. And he was ruthless. I mean, he put up all the toll gates he was allowed to, plus lots that he wasn't allowed to, because most people couldn't read the Act of Parliament under which, these toll gates were put up. And he'd put up sidebars as well, where he'd catch you if you were trying to cross a toll gate road. So he was basically fleecing people left, right and centre. And the farmers of West Wales, after a couple of years of this, thought, sorry, this can't happen anymore. So they got together by night. They enacted a very old folk ritual of cross-dressing. So men would dress as women would dress as men. They'd black their faces, so they were completely disguised. It was kind of night of misrule sort of thing. They would subject the tollgate to a mock trial, and having found it guilty, not to be worthy of sitting there, they would smash it up and burn it. And if they particularly didn't like the tollgate keeper, if he or she had been particularly ruthless, they'd knock the house down as well. And this went on, not like other riots, for 2 or 3 weeks. It went on for months and months and months over three counties. Because once it had started, it took off. It was like a wildfire, and so many different bands. I mean, this wasn't one band going around three counties. It was people thinking, that, we're doing that. And although they're called riots, hardly any of them were, because to be a riot, you had to have Riot Act read. And to read the Riot Act, you had to be I think it was the sheriff of the county, the undersheriff, or a magistrate. And none of those people ever got near one of these gate breakings. You know, the farmers would materialise at night.
They'd vanish.
Dematerialise into the countryside. So, and I just found this completely fascinating. And I thought, why? Why doesn't everybody know about this? And I wanted to write a book talking about it. But when I started writing, I thought, I don't want to write a book about the Rebecca riots.
Yes, right. I'm with you.
What I want to do is write a story which has that as a background. And the best thing seemed to be a crime book. I was reading a lot of crime at the time. I didn't start off my writing in crime, but I was reading a lot of crime at the time. And I thought, that's what I'll do. I'll set a murder during the time of the riots, and then we'll see where it goes.
I think it's fascinating because what we're saying is this is the unique Welsh history that you're not going to get if you read an English crime book at the same time. You will never get to any of this. And so it's really interesting from that point of view. And it leads us on to something else as well, which is, and it's relevant to crime writing today and what we're talking about with it suddenly becoming sort of something that people are beginning to discover. And it's the suppression of Welsh culture and identity.
Yeah.
That also accompanied this kind of English takeover, and particularly when coal and iron became so important to the economy.
Yeah.
And we have the Blue Books, for instance.
Oh, yes.
And so just talk a little bit about that suppression of Welsh culture that's been going on till today. I mean, it's not, still have hangovers of it.
It is still going on today because there is this myth that Wales is too small, too poor and too stupid to be independent. All those things are not true. I mean, countries much smaller and much poorer than Wales are managing independently. So it is still going on now for the same reason, because the UK needs Welsh resources. Then it needed coal and iron to push the empire forward. I mean, all the iron ships, all the trains, all the train tracks ran on iron and coal. And it was essential that Welsh people got with the program. And with the Rebecca riots and Chartism, which was very strong in Wales, I mean, the last person tried and convicted of high treason in Britain was a Chartist after the siege of the County Hotel in Newport.
Right.
Yes. And in theory, these people who were convicted of high treason should have been hung, drawn, and quartered, because
it was still the sentence.
I think it still is.
Yeah.
But I think the government realised that if they did that, they'd make martyrs of them, so they transported them instead. Very wise move. So all this was going on, and the government thought, what is it? What is it with these Welsh people? And bear in mind, at this time, we're not very long after the American War of Independence, we're not very long after the French Revolution. There were numerous revolutions always ready to kick off in Europe. And I think it's quite difficult for us to get our heads around in Britain, because we didn't have a revolution in the 19th century. Just how worried the Westminster government was that there would be a revolution in Wales, and that if the Chartists were part of that, that it would explode into the rest of Britain.
Yes.
And then all these terrible working class people will get above themselves, and then us who are supposed to be the
want the vote and
rulers,
then right.
They'll want the vote. Oh good God, what will happen then? So in the wake of the Rebecca riots and Chartism, the Westminster government sent in a Royal Commission of Inquiry to Wales, ostensibly to look at education. So it was called the Commission of Inquiry into the State of Education in Wales, and it was done in 1847. By three completely monoglot English Anglican clergymen. Bear in mind, 80% of people in Wales at the time, were nonconformists. So these were completely alien people to the Welsh populace. And to cut a long story short, having gone into every parish in Wales and investigated, what is the state of education here? Are there schools? What sort of schools are they? What sort of education are they offering? Is it Welsh or is it English? They wrote this very damning report in a series of blue books, which is, I think today, even now, parliamentary reports are written in blue books.
Right.
So that's why it's called blue books. And they basically came to several conclusions. One was that the Welsh language was holding the Welsh people back, because it wasn't a suitable vehicle for modern life and the modern world. It was only really suitable for the kind of the hearth, the farm, and the chapel, I think was the phrase used. So that they should be, teaching should all be done in English, and you know, people should be fitted for the modern world and a civilized language, you know, all of this. The second was that the Welsh family was degenerate because Welsh women were immoral and therefore were passing on their immorality to their children. And put those two things together, Welsh women's immorality and the Welsh language, and you foster this culture of being dishonest and immoral and lazy. And all complete lies. I mean, they went
with
the intention of saying these things and put all these mountains of evidence around it, which actually, evidence can, we all know, statistics and evidence can tell you anything you want.
But also, if you pick on a Welsh speaker and you interview them in English, And of course, they can't answer the questions.
Absolutely.
But the assumption you draw there is not that you're speaking the wrong language, but that they're stupid.
But that they're stupid. And when you're asking children, you're asking them Anglican catechism questions, which any child brought up in the Church of England would know. But of course, these children were brought up in the Nonconformist Church. They hadn't any idea what is the question you're asking. I don't recognize the words you're using or what answer you want, you know. So it was all dreadful. And a playwright wrote a play about this travesty a few years later, and he called it The Treason or the Treachery of the Blue Books, Brada Llyfrgelloesion. And that's what it's still known as now. And if you speak to any Welsh speaker in Wales, certainly over 30, and you say Brada Llyfrgelloesion, oh, they will know what you're talking about.
Yes.
It still felt very visceral.
I seriously hope that that's still something that's taught in school, and that, you know, the fact that, because we got taught Welsh history being from a Welsh school, you know, Welsh environment, and that it was important. But I think it is important to establish that, because it's almost then you think that the way the Welsh culture has managed to seep into English, so that even a writer like Dylan Thomas writing in English still has these Welsh rhythms and this Welsh feel to it, you know.
Absolutely.
It's almost a miracle that that did survive, but the point is it did survive.
Yeah.
We're back at the stage now where people can say openly, you know, hey, we want to reestablish this character. Counter that, or to slightly soften it, let's say, it's the fact that, of course, when you write a thriller series, as you did with the Tyvee Valley, a mystery series, you also need character and you also need mystery plots.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't work if you don't have that.
Oh, no.
And the essence of the books, and the thing I think that will pull people back to it as a series, is Harry Probert Lloyd.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who's the coroner. Tell us a little bit about Harry.
So Harry is 26 at the opening of the first book. He was peripherally involved in the Rebecca riots as a very young man, as a 17, 18-year-old young man, and got his fingers rather badly burned and was packed off to Oxford to study, and then from Oxford went to London, became a barrister, and up until he was 26 was living a lovely life, not particularly wanting to go back to West Wales after what had happened. Never really saw himself as the heir to the estate, although that's what he is. He's his father's only son. He doesn't really want to be a squire. He wants to be a lawyer.
No, right.
But when he's 26, he finally has to admit that the visual disturbances he's getting are not just eye strain from overwork. He is going blind.
Yes.
He's actually got what we would now know as macular degeneration, which they hadn't named then, although it had been described, interestingly. He's actually got a juvenile form of that called Stargardt's disease, but that wasn't described till later, but that's what he's got. So he's forced home. He can't practice as a barrister anymore. He can't read. He can write, but barely. He can't interview people because he can't see them. And he can't live independently, so he has to go home and is very, very sad about that and quite angry and bitter and generally thinks life's against him. And then he's not been home very long when a messenger comes knocking on the door wanting his father, who's, as the squire, is one of the local magistrates, to say that human remains have been found on the local farm. And Harry says, well, tough, sorry, my father's not here. You'll have to make do with me. And as he's going over to where this body's been discovered and he's talking to the witness, he thinks, oh, dear, I know who this is. I know who these remains belong to. This is somebody that I was involved with back when getting involved with the Rebecca riots. I wondered what had happened to her. I looked for her, couldn't find her. And I've wondered for the last 8 years what became of her. And now I think I know. When the remains are dug up, there's evidence that, yes, it is this young woman.
Yes, right.
So he makes it his business to find out what happened to her in the teeth of much local opposition. The magistrates do not want this investigated. They just want her remains given a decent crystal burial and forgotten about, because quite clear from when she disappeared that this was a killing that took place during the Rebecca riots, and they do not want to resurrect
her. They just don't want to revisit
it. Thank you. And he won't let it go because he feels he let her down then and he's not going to let her down now. So he leaves no stone unturned looking for her killer. But he has to have help because of his blindness. So he recruits a local young lawyer's clerk, John Davis, who's 19, and the two of them start working together. And it only becomes apparent as the book progresses that John knows a lot more about this case than he's letting on. And the reader then gets very privileged information, because only the reader knows what both Harry and John know. So the reader can come to conclusions before either of the two young men, which I quite enjoyed doing that.
Yeah, I bet you did. And it's a really good relationship between the two of them. But Harry, I think, is such an interesting character, because he's got that privileged background to some extent, but at the same time, he's a very compassionate man.
Yeah.
And he also has feet of clay, which makes him very human like us. I do love the fact that he can be super intelligent in his investigative work sometimes, and yet he can be a right messy so-and-so when it comes to his personal life.
Absolutely, yeah. He's often not honest with himself, and he's a bit of a mess. He needs John to tell him what to do and to take him in hand on occasion.
Yes.
I love Harry.
There are times when you sort of think, John, please, say that again, will you? Just remind him, will you please?
Say it again and louder. I mean, the weird thing is that Harry, as the son of the squire, who doesn't want to be, Harry would love to be John, and John would love to be Harry. I mean, John, having grown up in poverty and really dragged himself up by his bootstraps as an orphan, and he looks at Harry and he thinks, what is your problem? You know, you're moaning on about all of this and you've got literally zero problems. Come on, get your act together.
And there's another aspect to it, which I think, I don't know whether this is true or not, whether it's just that history is always sort of on a cusp of change. But it felt like the story of this coroner is also at the time when it was codifying, you know, when legal things were coming in, when more rules and bureaucracy and that were being part of the issue.
Yeah.
And I think we get other cusps when it comes to a bitter remedy, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
Is that fair? Is that something that interests you, that change?
Yes. I mean, to be honest, I didn't know that I didn't know anything about the role of coroner until I started writing the book. It's set when it is because of the Rebecca riot.
That's why.
But I made Harry coroner. Well, he's not coroner in the first book. He becomes stand-in or locum coroner at the end of the first book. I don't think that's a spoiler because it's called the Diving Valley Coroner. So I had to do a ton of research about the coroner's role, both for subsequent books, but also for that one, because there is a very pivotal scene in None So Blind, the first book, which is the inquest into Margaret Jones's death. So I had to do a lot of research into what the role of coroner was at the time. And it's very different to now. And you're quite right. It was on the cusp at the time. None So Blind is set in 1851.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, there were suggestions that the role of coroner was completely outdated and it should just be got rid of. That, you know, gosh, this is a bit of a hangover from the medieval period. But there were other people who very much felt, and a lot of people still feel like this now, that the only person speaking for the dead was the coroner. And that because they had this very free-ranging role, if you like, they could go anywhere and ask anybody anything.
Mm.
Because there was very little in the way of legislation about how coroners had to do their work. They had huge latitude in how they plied their trade. And some coroners, you know, throughout the whole of the UK were incredibly dilatory and basically employed deputies and basically didn't do it. They just enjoyed the status of being coroner.
Right.
And others, like Harry, were incredibly diligent and really did want to find out what had gone on. And they were some of the people who were in the vanguard of making the investigation of death into what we now know. They helped the kind of nascent science of forensics and autopsy take hold, because at the time, certainly when Harry's investigating this first case, we are less than 20 years after the Anatomy Act, which was in 1860, which provided for hanged felons and unclaimed paupers' bodies to be used in medical anatomy. Prior to that, it was only the hanged felons, and therefore you got the resurrection men who would dig up bodies and all of this, because obviously medical students have to practice. But suddenly you've got more bodies available. But here we are, less than 20 years from that change of law, and people still associate anatomy and cutting up of bodies with the disgrace of having been hanged.
Yes.
And so people don't want autopsies to take place. Thank you.
I hadn't thought about it quite like that, but yes, I see.
It's a really, it's got a nasty whiff. And also there was this kind of Christian thing of
that's the sort of angle I was.
Absolutely. But it was both. It was both.
Right.
Coroners could insist on there being an autopsy. They didn't have to, and there were some coroners who never asked for one.
Yeah, right.
But In the second book, Harry teams up with somebody who becomes his favoured medical witness, Benton Reckitt, who has a mania for autopsy. He wants to find out how people died. He wants to push medical science forward, and he will take anybody he can get and cut them up. He's a great character. He was meant to be.
And thank God there were people like him.
Absolutely. And there were people like this. And Harry's attitude, actually, as coroner, once he becomes coroner, is based on a real coroner. He was called Thomas Wakeley. He was an MP. He was a doctor. He was the founding editor of The Lancet, you know, the doctor's magazine.
Right,
and he was coroner for Middlesex. And he felt that the coroner's role was incredibly important. He thought only doctors should be coroners. He thought all this nonsense of having lawyers as coroners was a terrible, terrible idea. Because how do they know what they're looking at, you know? And of course, that's never happened. But, but he was one of the people who really was instrumental in bringing about the Coroner's Act, which I think I'm going to forget which year it was. It was in the early 1860s, where coroners suddenly their role was slightly more codified and they were paid.
Right.
Up until that point, they were given expenses. And that was all.
So yeah, that's another good point, isn't it?
You had to be a gentleman of independent means.
Of course. And if you want a job done, you're still better if you pay people to actually do it if you expect it to be done.
Because then you'll get the best people. Absolutely. So,
I think that's a really good picture of that we're building now about those novels. And as I said, I think people will be interested in those themes as well. But we kind of it's almost like we're going now another level and add another set of themes to it, if you like, because we're going to talk a little bit about A Bitter Remedy.
Yeah.
And I think we start by, if you could please, Alice, give us a little introduction to the book and the story.
Okay. So we're in 1881 now in Oxford. I didn't want to sever my connection with Wales. So I've taken a young woman from the Teivi Valley area to Oxford. She's a young, I mean, the blurb calls her a polymath. She's a highly intelligent person who's interested in lots of things. She's a mathematician. She's a linguist. She's very, very curious. She'd flirted with being a doctor at one stage, but that looked as if that door was closed. There was one female doctor at the time, Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, and she kind of went through via a back door, which was then very firmly slammed shut behind her.
Yes, right.
So Non ends up in Oxford at the time when women were just putting their toe into the waters of university education in Oxford. In the 1860s and 70s, dons, wives, sisters, daughters, who obviously were taking part in the life of the university, decided that they would like to have some degree of university education. So they set up lectures for ladies, whereby some of the university lecturers would deliver their lectures completely separately and in very chaperoned circumstances to these ladies. And out of that developed the Association for Promoting the Higher Education of Women in Oxford, commonly known as the AEW, which had as its aim, some people in the AEW had as their aim the complete inclusion of women in the University of Oxford as full members. Others just wanted better education for women and some access to higher education. So in 1881, London University has been issuing degrees to women for a couple of years now. There are already two women's colleges in Cambridge, Newnham and Girton. But Oxford seemed much more... It was a tremendously conservative place in the 1880s. I mean, don't think about the Oxford that we know now.
I know, that's the thing, isn't it? You've got to think about these academic institutions completely differently to the way we now see them as more radical.
Yeah. Oh, Oxford was such a provincial town. And the university, I mean, it wasn't the academic powerhouse that it is now. And neither was Cambridge. London was stealing those clothes left, right and centre, because London University, so King's and University Colleges in London, were powering on into the scientific age, whereas Oxford, particularly Oxford, was still very much, its main thing was the classics. It felt it was there to educate politicians and clergymen, primarily.
Yeah, the theology is still
hugely important. But that's beginning to change. And it's into that stream of change that the AEW and the women of the Association for Promoting the Higher Education of Women in Oxford, and men. The AEW was, there were a lot of men right. involved. Otherwise, it would never have got off the ground. Nobody would listen to women. So it's into that sort of stream of change that, that this movement for the education of women is inserted. But Oxford was, it lagged behind Cambridge quite considerably, because when Somerville and Lady Margaret Hall were set up, they were just set up as residences for young women who'd come to access these lectures for ladies. They were not colleges. They didn't teach there. They were not academic institutions at all. They were like large family, middle-class homes, if you like. Mm. But quite soon, once they came on board, the men who'd been lecturing to the ladies said, hold on a minute, this is ridiculous. We're delivering our lectures in our colleges, and then we're delivering the same lectures to you. I think it'd be a good idea if we started admitting you, the ladies, to the colleges. And it happened quite slowly and gradually. A couple of colleges started first. I think the first college was a chemistry lecturer at Christchurch who said, right. I am not doing these practical sessions twice. You can jolly well come to my practicals in Christchurch. And that kind of opened the floodgates. And over 3, 4, 5 years, nearly all the colleges joined in. But it was very interesting because you definitely got a kind of a split in both the academics and the undergraduates. You know, there were academics and undergraduates who thought, yes, this is a great thing, about time too. And then there were others who weren't having it at any price. And of course, for a crime writer, conflict like that, you can't buy it, can you? But you want conflict. And then you've got the conflict between town and gown, because Oxford University was the biggest employer in Oxford at the town at the time. And it was enormously influential in a way that it isn't now. I mean, half the police force belonged to the university.
Yes, right.
There were 2 MPs for Oxford University and only one for the town. It was mad. There were academics on the town council and, you know, at various levels. And the university would veto things in the town that it didn't like. So, for instance, the Great Western Railway was mooting building a new carriage works in Oxford in the late 1860s, which would have brought huge prosperity to Oxford and you know, brought people in,
jobs and people. Mm.
But it would have made the town very different. It would suddenly have had an industrial character. And the university academics went, no, not happening.
Right.
We're not going to allow it. And it didn't. It went to Swindon instead.
Yeah. So. It seems mad. And that's why Swindon was the hub that it was.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
That's interesting, isn't it?
I know, right?
Looking at the kind of mystery element of the novel first, because there's a lot I want to pick up on in what you said there, actually. But it's poor Sidney Parker.
Oh, and bless him.
And you do feel sorry for the poor man.
Oh, you do feel sorry for him. Oh, gosh, absolutely.
And it's difficult to talk about this without giving too many spoilers away. I don't want to point people in directions, which I think is key.
Okay.
But this is a mystery totally grounded in Victorian values and beliefs and issues.
Yes.
What can we actually say about the mystery in that sense?
Well, I think there are 2 things. The thing which kind of inspired this book was reading contemporary newspapers.
I see.
Which I started doing when I was reading writing the Tiber Valley Coroner series. Mm-hmm. Because if you want to know what people were doing, what they were thinking, what they were wearing, what their attitudes were, don't read history books, because that's a historian's
opinion. Yes, right. It's an interpretation.
Read the papers. Oh, my gosh, they are a treasure trove. And I was reading all these advertisements. And you've got to bear in mind that newspapers have adverts in now. Then they were packed. I mean, the front 3 or 4 pages, the first 3 or 4 pages of the local Oxford papers were just wall-to-wall adverts. That was it. There was no...
And adverts for absolutely everything under the sun.
Absolutely everything under the sun. And I kept coming across these patent remedies. And of course, then there was no advertising standards. There was no Trades Descriptions Act. You could make all these wild claims for your powders, elixirs, ointments, whatever, in the way that spam that comes into your inbox now does. I mean, that's the unregulated part of our advertising industry now. And these things that are in the newspaper are very much like that. They make these wild and outrageous claims.
Yes, they do.
And some things are still around now. Beecham's powders, you know, I think they're still around now. They were being advertised then. Coleman's mustard, you know, this sort of thing. But there were also literal snake oil salesmen. And I thought that would be really interesting to go into that world and see what they were doing. And I came upon this. Do you want me to talk about the particular ailment?
Do you want to talk about it?
Oh, I think maybe I will, because it's so key. Everybody's heard of hysteria, right?
Right.
So this is the female malady par excellence of the Victorian period, which didn't really exist. I mean, it was a catch-all for so many things.
Like melancholia.
Melancholia, all sorts of mental and physical issues were put down to hysteria.
Now we have to appreciate it's to do with postpartum trauma and all those things, you know,
and
they just lumped under this.
Absolutely.
Oh, it's women.
It's women. They've got a womb. Who knows what's happening with that? Hormones. No. But what people don't know about is that...
And I didn't know.
No, well, what they'll know now is the equally spurious, but also very, very widely believed in male disease of spermatorrhea.
Right.
Which you were supposed to get from excessive, shall we say, self-abuse?
Yes.
That was their
onanism.
Term then. Onanism, exactly. Yes, onanism. And there were lots of books produced about the evil effects of onanism and what spermatorrhea would do. And it would basically, if you had a symptom, anything from a headache to a pretty much a broken leg, spermatorrhea, you need these pills to stop you. So you were supposed to be involuntarily ejecting your vital seed and not even knowing you've done it. Oh, it's coming away in your urine. And it's like, there's literally no way of proving or disproving this. So any man could have it. Literally any man could have it. So if you were feeling a bit off, you'd think, oh my goodness, maybe it's this terrible thing, spermatorrhea. And then you'd buy these books and you think, oh gosh, if I don't do something, I don't take these pills and powders and...
So it creates a kind of moral panic, doesn't it?
I might die. Oh, moral panic is exactly what it was. Because behind this were the moral police who did not want men masturbating, basically, because they thought it would weaken men. So this is where the whole muscular Christianity, the Corinthian spirit, the rugby and cold showers things comes in, you know. Don't be sitting in your room, you know, being too obsessed with yourself, young man. You know, come out on the rugby.
Get out there in the fresh
manly
air.
Manly things, exactly.
Yeah, hit somebody.
That's one of the recommendations, yeah. Fresh air and healthy exercise, you know. Oh, my goodness. Because I think there was, spermatorrhea is obviously completely ridiculous.
Yes.
But there was this worry that if young men became obsessed with masturbation and sex in general, that it would weaken them somehow. And that we then wouldn't have young men who were fresh to go out and rule the empire and keep make England great or Britain great. And it's fascinating.
It
is. As opposed to those we did find it. And they didn't just have these powders and elixirs. There were physical, I'm not going to talk about the physical instruments, but there were physical instruments which they advertised that young men could use to regulate their urges. and they pop up in the book. And they were, oh my giddy aunt, quite astonishing. So, yeah, but I was just amazed. I mean, you read these books and you think, but surely nobody could believe that all these ridiculously diverse symptoms could come from one thing. It's just... But then they didn't have the modern medicine that we have now. So
I know, and we have to be careful about how we put our own views and our own values on it. So I'm assuming actually that's something that's very difficult as a when you write an historical novel, you kind of have to divest yourself of all that modern knowledge.
You do.
Because your characters can't show that, can they? I mean,
exactly.
If they...
Except at the time, this is why it's very interesting writing in the 19th century and particularly by the time we reached the 1880s, because there were still people who were kind of living, even doctors, who were sort of living in the medical and scientific dark ages because they hadn't the urge to find out what was going on in the modern world. And then you had people who were really right at the cutting edge. So, you know, I can have people of all different kinds of opinion.
So
of
you can have progressive and people.
Absolutely. Which is great. Mm. So you can have people of all different stripes and opinion, which is fantastic.
I notice one thing you do is you keep the murders very grounded. You like to have, you know, it's very solid, it's very real at the end of the day, and it makes it feel
I suppose it has more impact for that because it's got a social realism to it rather than this flighty stuff.
Yeah. I think that's something that really, really interests me. Social realism, that's you couldn't have pleased me more. I'm not interested in writing historical crime, which is just using history as a picturesque backdrop. I really want people to feel that they're there and that they're living in the real. I mean, obviously, I have no idea what the real 19th century
is.
But I want to give at least the illusion that this might be what the 19th century was like. And I'm not interested in setting lurid ritual or serial deaths in my books. I want these to be the sort of deaths which really were investigated. I mean, and this was a habit I developed in the Tivy Valley Coroner series.
Yes, I can see that.
The coroner would investigate not just murders, but any sudden and unexpected deaths.
Right.
In fact, some of the deaths in the Tivy Valley Coroner series are not murders.
Yes.
They're
yes.
investigated as murders and they turn out not to be. And that sort of took hold of me then. I thought, yes, that's the kind of death I want to write about, something that really could have happened. Because my aim really is to have my characters investigating a death which could only have arisen out of those circumstances. It's not a death that could happen now and has just been transplanted then. It arises organically out of the social circumstances and the events that were happening then, you know, the social history, if you like. I mean, I've given up saying I'm fascinated by history because it turns people off. They think, oh, history at school, no, boring, boring. What I say now is I'm fascinated by the way people lived in the past because that's the truth.
I
couldn't care less about political history and military history. It doesn't interest
me. No, I think it's the way you teach history and the way we talk about history. And the thing about history is, as you point out, realizing it's about people. Because and on that point, I mean, if we look at Non, for instance, she's a role model or she's a stand-in for all the women at that time who were pioneers and doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Non is kind of based on somebody who appears in the books.
Right.
Her sponsor. So Non is the daughter of a sea captain. And don't think Royal Navy, think little boats going up and down the West Coast.
Yes,
whales carrying limestone and coal around. He dies, and she and her mother are left penniless. So her dream of going to Oxford looks as if it's shattered. But then a local friend of the family and very famous Welsh woman decides to sponsor her. And this woman is Sarah Jane Rees, also known by her bardic name of Cranogwen, who was tremendously famous in Wales at the time as a poet, a speaker, a preacher, a temperance organiser, and a writer and editor of a women's magazine. And nobody's ever heard of her in England, and they hadn't then.
No. Was she the first woman to win a prize at the
Estelle? She was.
Right.
What passed as the national... There wasn't an avowedly national Estelle in those days, but there were big Estelle that people recognised as having national significance. And she competed in this one and beat the two most famous Welsh poets of the day, Islwyn Ceiriog, who were absolutely, horrified, I think, this young whippersnapper of a woman who had no background in any of this would come and snatch their victory away.
Yeah.
And although I've got Cranogwen in the book, she only ever appears off screen because she's non-sponsored. But Non is kind of inspired by her. I mean,
I wondered about that.
My writing of her is inspired by Cranogwen, but also Non herself is inspired by Cranogwen because she thinks all these things are possible. You know, I can do all of this. But again, we're going back to women's experience in Wales and England being entirely different. So Non has had a certain amount of freedom. She's worked on her father's ships, for instance. She's taught navigation to sailors. And women did that in West Wales at the time. Women, on the whole, were the navigation teachers, interestingly.
Yes.
Cranogwen did that for a period. So Non has done those things. She's taught herself. She's gone through the local village school and has now taught herself lots of things. She's taught herself Latin and Greek and ancient Hebrew. Mm-hmm. She taught herself various mathematics. She's been writing to Lewis Carroll, also known as Charles Dodgson, who was a mathematical lecturer at Oxford. Yes. So she comes to Oxford with that background. And she gets to Oxford and it's like, oh, dear God on a bike, what is this? Because there's no freedom. There's all this middle-class angst about young women and how they need to be protected. And the women going to lectures in colleges had to be chaperoned. They literally
She's got Lily.
Walk through the door. And some of the Lady Margaret Halls, they weren't happy at all about their young women going into town by themselves. Yeah. You know, even a gaggle of them. Yeah, no, they'd have to have an older, more respectable woman with them. And Nonne is like, no, I'm not doing any of this.
It is one of the fascinating. I get now more when you say about the independence that she brought of a sort of spirit of Welsh women that comes into this. But obviously, there's so many strictures around this Victorian era.
Oh, absolutely.
One of the things is that there's this dispute, that's not a fair way to put it, but we obviously this develops into the suffragette movement for the vote. And of course, it's about women's colleges and women being allowed to do degrees. In Nonne's case, she's here for the right to go to lectures.
Yes.
Not even to get a degree, but just to be there because she wants to study.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting contrast there as well between some of the men as well, because we kind of realize that some of the men aren't there for they are there for a degree, but they only want it because they want to tick a box.
Oh, absolutely.
Then they can move on to the things they've been allocated in life.
Totally. And some men went and did do a degree. Some just went, footled about for a few years, met the right people and then left. And you could also register for what's called a pass degree, which basically, if you read a few books, went to a few lectures, you didn't have to try very hard. Yeah, you could just get a pass degree. And it wasn't an honours degree in the way that it is now. I mean, the academic standard at Oxford wasn't particularly high then, because a lot of the men there were on tied scholarships to particular schools. So New College only took boys from Winchester College. That was it.
Right.
So that wasn't very difficult to get in.
Very hard to get in then. Yeah.
Half of Christchurch undergraduates were from Eton. You know, so basically, if you went to the right schools, you could just be shooed into Oxford.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I mean, in all honesty, it hasn't totally changed, has it, given the number of private school pupils there still are at Oxford and Cambridge? Be political, I suppose. But one of the interesting things is the politics of the movement.
Yeah.
And you talked about the AEW and getting women's education and that. And of course, they're responsible for Nonne while she's there.
Yes.
And you feel this heavy hand that's over her the whole. She's always being watched. Everything is subject to being watched.
She is.
And it's. The thing is that they want exactly the same end she does, or at least some of them do.
Some of them do.
But it's a question of how you fight that battle.
That's it. Nonne wants to go in all guns blazing like a bull in a china shop. And the women of the AEW know, or at least very strongly suspect, that that is not the way to do it. It's got to be softy, softy, catchy monkey. And what Nonne has to decide is how many compromises is she prepared to make. I mean, there are things that she is just not going to do. I mean, she does go to lectures with a chaperone. She takes her landlady, who's also her dad's second cousin. Yes. Typical Wales, you know. I'm lodging with my cousin. Of course I am, yes. but when she goes around Oxford, she's not chaperoned. In fact, she rides around on a tandem tricycle, which she won in a bet, which I like very much. So it's that. I mean, Nonne shows in the difficulties that she has to navigate what the different currents in the politics of women's education were at the time. Yeah. Because there was every shade of opinion, from women should never be allowed to darken the door of a university because it'll corrupt their little minds and they won't be capable of being wives and mothers, to women are the same as men, go away. And there literally were all those shades of opinion.
All the shades,
We didn't have the suffragettes yet, but the suffragist movement was definitely underway by this point.
And of course that develops to the point where people say then, well, this is not enough, we need protest.
Absolutely.
And then you can get into violent protest.
Oh, yeah, and I'm looking forward to getting to that at some point.
I thought you might be.
Yeah. Nonne's well up for a ruckus.
I wonder how people will see Nonne, some people anyway. It'd be interesting to see how they judge the attitude of a young woman, because she's forthright.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, I was thinking all the time, you know, if a young man had been forthright in the same way, the thing she did with Liz Estrada at the start of it, you know, and then a young man had insisted, in a sense, on getting himself embroiled in a murder mystery.
Yeah.
How that would be seen as a male character, you know, and it's interesting, the words people, the adjectives and the adverbs that people would use. It'd just be interesting to see the comparisons.
Oh, completely. Well, I mean, Tali Askew does get pulled into the murder investigation with Sidney Park.
Right.
Because he's enamoured of Nonne and he wants to wants to get in there and protect her, yes. Well, not protect her, but do what he can for her. And of course, he is feted and almost literally carried around on people's shoulders. Whereas if she owned up to what she'd done, I mean, yes. There would have been mass condemnation. And the AEW isn't having that at any price. So again, there's this pivotal scene where she has to decide, am I going to tell the truth? Or for the greater good, am I going to keep quiet?
I keep quiet.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that is fascinating. The other that we did talk about, or the possibility of that some men, and I mean, this goes to Basil Rice and other characters. I'd give him a minute, or in a minute, I'd rather talk about him. But just one before we do. It's this thing about the guys who are on the other side. Now, with modern eyes, we see their arguments as completely stupid. You know, women are not fit to go to education, women, all that kind of stuff that's there. And it kind of shows up in the characters who run the colleges and things like that. I'm just wondering how difficult it is to write these kind of characters so that you get them as men of their time, but don't, is it difficult to avoid straying into a kind of caricature, if you like, because they are, they're natural born stereotypes.
It is a bit difficult, to be honest, because, I mean, like I said, there was every shade of opinion on the spectrum, and there were men. I mean, and Benjamin Jarrett, who is about to, in the second book, he's about to become vice chancellor of the university, right. In other words, top dog, basically, because we all know the chancellor does nothing. It's just a figurehead. His attitude to women was changing. He was great friends with Florence Nightingale and George Eliot, and they really changed his mind about women's capabilities. But to the end of his life, he's still worried about the effect on, I think, the average woman of university education. I think he thought that these very intelligent, very capable and able women were almost outliers in the population, you know, and not like you would see a man. Oh, you know, there are lots and lots of very clever men, you know, stupid men as well. I think they thought of women almost as a separate species to men, you know, unlike men who could be incredibly bright to incredibly stupid. I think they saw women as a different class of person who wasn't primarily identified or defined by her intellect, but by her emotions and by her ability to do what she was, quotes, meant to do, which was be a wife and a mother. You know, there was this deification, really, of the mother in the Victorian period. You know, women were put on a pedestal and seen as domestic goddesses in a way, because they were the moral guides of their children. They were those who developed the character of their children. And that was seen to be incredibly important. And I'm not going to argue with that. That is important. But when that's seen as the only thing women can do, obviously, that's a problem. And I think a lot of the men who proclaimed loudly, this will make them unfit wives and mothers.
Right.
They were using that, they were allowing that to be seen as a kind of, it'll badly affect their minds. Whereas actually that was code for they will become ambitious, they will see that there's a life outside the home, and then they won't want to be wives and mothers. And I think there was a genuine fear that if you educated your women, your young women, in the same way that young men were educated, then there would be this mass exodus out of family life. So, yeah.
I suppose, you have to see these things differently. I mean, for instance, I suppose if I was a very young man, you asked me about temperance, I would have just said it was silly.
Yes.
You know, because obviously I like drinking and that.
Sure.
But when you actually think about it, when you think about the way families were, and if a guy got his wages on a Friday night or a Saturday morning and went and spent it all on the pub before the weekend was over, you can see how destructive that actually is for families. So it's, you know, it's not as it's been characterized over the years as some kind of crazy movement. You know, about this religious objection to alcohol.
Not at all. Interestingly, that's the theme of the second book, Temperance and the Salvation Army, because the Salvation Army was not the movement it is now. We all think of them as incredibly cozy and cuddly and lovely.
Right.
They were seen as horrifically radical, almost heretical. And outrageous, because they would parade in the streets and literally sing and dance in the streets, which was so completely foreign to the churchmen of the period. Anyway, I'm straying into the second book now. But yes, absolutely. Temperance, the attitude to drink then was almost exactly the attitude to drugs now.
Right. Yes, almost I see. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good analogy.
Yeah. It's fascinating.
As I said, I did say we'd mention Basil Rice and give him his words. Yeah, give him a few words. Well, the first thing is there's a kind of practicality to Basil because there are things that Non can't do in terms of the investigation. So obviously that. But why did you decide to go for this dual narrative, if you like, in the sense, or have these two perspectives in the novel?
Partly because in the Harry and John books, the dual, I like that dual narrative.
Yeah,
I like
right.
being able to tell a story from two different standpoints.
Right.
It also means that you're not completely confined because first person narrative and all my characters are first person narrators. If you just have one first person narrator, you've got a very limited palette.
Right.
Whereas if you've got two first person narrators, you've doubled your palette, which is useful. I mean, you still can't see the baddies doing their thing unless one of the central characters is there. But
yes,
at least
right.
you've got two eyes on the situation and their opinions on them. And I like that batting between the two. I like the way two characters can kind of trade off against each other. But I also wanted to do the town gown thing. Because Non is
right.
not a member of the university. She lives with a family. She's town. She may have aspirations to be gown, but she's town. Whereas Basil is absolutely your establishment. He's a don at Jesus College. Jesus College being the Welsh college. So again, I've gone for the Welsh theme. And Basil just interesting. I mean, this is because I'm a pantser, not a plotter. I don't sit and plan my characters. I don't write character sketches. They just develop on the page. And both Non and Basil
That's
just leapt off the page for me. They were just kind of there, fully formed, which is fantastic. And Basil is this rather, he's got a secret in his life.
Yes.
Which means that he has to be very careful all the time. So he's constantly watching what he says, watching what other people say, watching other people's attitude to him, wondering what's behind their attitude to him and all of that. So he's, Non is like a bull in a china shop. Basil is constantly holding back, looking at the situation, being very circumspect. So they're very different in that respect. He's a man who's been through the public school system. You know, he is your establishment bloke, and he can represent the university standpoint, but from a slightly left field standpoint again, because he's Welsh. Although he's not a Welsh speaker, but when we first meet him, he's from Monmouthshire. And in Monmouthshire, certainly in the middle classes, Welsh speaking had died out at that point. So he's Welsh, so he's slightly different from other academics. He's got this secret in his life. He's also quite a progressive for various reasons. So he's completely in sympathy with the aims of the AEW and Non.
I think that's really interesting to see the way he is progressive. And these two kind of, they're forced to work together almost in a sense. It's not that they're not friends, but it's the formality and everything that's in the relationship, you know, at the start, when they're forced to work together and it has to. And so you get in that relationship, you get the woman and the man and you get town and gown.
Yeah.
And it's a whole bundle of things come together. And that is, it starts off a striking relationship.
Yes, absolutely. And they influence each other. I mean, and it's interesting to see now I'm writing the second book. They've already knocked some corners off each other, you know.
Right.
Non's inspired Basil to be a little bit less circumspect. He's managed to restrain her bull in a china shop instincts to some extent, and because she's a bright woman, she is going to change. She's going to moderate herself. She's going.
Yes, right.
She is already learning the art of compromise. She doesn't like it, and because it's a first person narrative, the reader can see just how little she likes it. But she is learning to compromise. And I think that the relationship between the two of them enables me to show how things are changing in the university as well, because
we're
through a tremendous change in university. We're moving from, as I was saying, a university where young men went almost like a finishing school, if you like. We're on the cusp here where there'd been a royal commission to say, this university, it's not really doing its job very well. Come on, you need to get with the programme. You need to have some, because they had fellows who were being paid by colleges to do nothing. They didn't even live there. They've just given money because they were fellows.
Totally crazy.
And they said, this is ridiculous. If you're a fellow, you've got to come and live here. You've got to teach. So, again, it's a very formative period.
Because this is still a period where you've got Darwinism is obviously more important, but you've still got that against the background of the religious bias.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Darwinism is a thing, but it's by no means accepted by everybody. So again, you've got this kind of schism between the progressives who are, they're all for Darwin and they're all for modern medicine and they're all for science and maybe religion is all baloney. So, you know, you are getting people who are quite happy to admit to being atheists at this point, where a century before, that would have been entirely shocking and scandalous. Yes,
absolutely.
I mean, I think Shelley was sent down from the university college for being an atheist. Yeah, and that was,
And I admire him for his independence in that sense, you know, to be somebody to stand up and say that. Quite incredible at that time.
Yeah, absolutely.
For me, this also, we've talked about it, and it's clear from the way we've been talking, it is about politics and other issues. For you, do you feel that crime fiction in general is a sort of, it is a social form? It's the social novel in a sense. I feel this is possibly the most progressive novel, even including literary novels, when it comes to actually exploring society.
I completely agree. I think it's the most flexible form we've got for investigating society, actually. And I think some of our best crime writers are some of our best writers in Britain. I mean, I'm thinking of people like Denise Miner. You know, she's investigating social aspects to things. Trevor Wood with his Homeless trilogy, amazing. I think, yes, the crime novel is an amazing vehicle for exploring any aspect of society, whether it's contemporary society or historical society. Because the minute you put people in extreme circumstances, and murder and sudden death are always extreme, then you're going to expose what lies beneath the surface.
Right.
And that's the point at which you can kind of unpick what's going on in society. Mm. Because we all like to pretend that everything's lovely, but it really isn't, is it?
No, it really isn't. And I think when it comes to historical writing in particular, you can see from the historical writing, the writing you're doing, how we got to where we are now.
Oh, yeah.
And absolutely. We can make comparisons now. So we say, you know, well, we've made progress, but have we made as much progress as we should have made? And the answer to that question is obviously no.
Absolutely. I mean, Andrew Taylor, he did an interview recently that I heard, I think it was with the Red Hot Chili Writers.
Oh, right. Yes.
Yeah. And he said that the inspiration for his latest book, The Shadows of London, was the Harvey Weinstein and Jeffrey Epstein.
Right, yes, right.
The grooming of young women, the procurement of young women, the abuse of young women. And he's told a story about all those things happening in the 17th century. And you look at this and you think, nothing, literally nothing.
It's changed.
I mean, Laura Shepherd Robinson did the same in Daughters of Night.
Mm.
She showed the kind of, if you like, high-class prostitute world, that demi-monde. Yes. And she mentioned that there was basically a catalogue of high-class prostitutes showing what they did and what, you know, how much you'd have to pay.
Paris's list,
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and auctions of virginity and all this. And I thought, oh, God, that would never happen now. And literally the week that I read that book, I heard on a podcast about these websites where young women would advertise for sugar daddies.
Yeah, right.
And I thought, there you go. Nothing has changed.
That's 300 years and here we are.
That's 300 years and here we are. Nothing changes. Oh, dear Lord on a bike. And like I was saying about the patent medicines, you know, when I was looking at those, I thought, yeah, but we've got advertising standards now. We're beyond all that. And then you see what's in your spam folder and you think, no, we're not.
Yeah, there we're not it is. At all. You know? Yeah, absolutely.
Because human nature doesn't change. And human nature is, there's a nasty corrupt streak to human nature. Not in everybody, but it's there in the underbelly. And of course, that's what crime fiction is looking at.
Yes, absolutely. And we have an incredible capacity for messing things up. We get a lot of things right, but blimey, we get an awful lot of things wrong. And we're very good at that.
Absolutely.
So we know there's going to be another Non and Basil novel. Yeah. We know the second one. You even told us a little bit about it. Yeah. I mean, is this a series you can see going on, though? You know,
I hope so. I've already got 4 plots in my mind, so I'm writing one at the minute. It's got another 2, and I would love to take it forward. showing, I mean, one of the things I'd like to do would be to show the development of the women's colleges, but that in conjunction with suffragism and the suffragettes. I mean, none is 100% going to be a suffragette, 100%. But it just depends, really, whether none and Basil capture people's imagination. I hope they will. I mean, the people who've been kind enough to read proofs have been very, very positive about
it. I hope so, too. I'd be very surprised if they don't. I think it's a fantastic novel.
Well,
I
really do think it's a
fantastic novel.
That's very kind.
One last question, then. How about a recommendation? I mean, we've talked about a few books along the way, actually, but...
Goodness. When I was starting to write historical crime, I suddenly started reading a lot of historical crime.
Right.
And two female authors really struck me, who I just think should be far, far, far better known than they are.
Right.
And those are Miranda Carter and Imogen Robertson. Miranda Carter, for her Blake and Avery series. I mean, she started writing crime fiction set in India before Abir Mukherjee and Vasim Khan came on the scene. Her The Strangler Vine was published in 2014.
Yeah, I remember it.
Just brilliant. I mean, I was blown away by that book. And Imogen Robertson's Crowther and Westerman series. I mean, again, she's got a woman who's struggling against the social strictures of her time. She's in the 1780s. Yes. And again, she has an anatomist. I mean, I love her books, but they're just not very well known. So both of those, Miranda Carter and Imogen Robertson, I can't recommend them highly enough. They're just fantastic.
Okay, we'll put that in the program notes so people get a chance to see it if they want to. Alice, I've really enjoyed that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I've had a lovely time, Paul. Thank you.
So a huge thank you to Alice Hawkins for a brilliant chat about her book, A Bitter Remedy. I think you'd agree that was insightful and entertaining. A Bitter Remedy is available in hardback and ebook, and you can get it from all good book outlets. If you'd like to order it from us, you can get it by clicking the link on the program notes, and that will take you to bookshot.org, and you can buy the book there. Once again, thank you very much to Canelo Crime for sponsoring this episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please rate and subscribe with your favourite podcast provider, and that helps us immensely. So I'll be back with another interview very shortly, but for now, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.